All right, there we're underway with the recording. All right, let's see where we have been in chapter 48, the final chapter of Ezekiel the prophet. Last week we were looking at the tribal territory that has already been determined for the tribes during the Messianic Kingdom. When Ezekiel wrote this around 586 BC, he was given this revelation, and so these tribal territories are set. Remember in earlier lessons, we were looking at throwing the lot to determine territory. Again, that must be for family territories, because this section of the chapter shows us that the tribal territories are already determined. Now, the whole context of the chapter moves from south to north. Excuse me, moves from north to south. There, I've got it right now. Moves from north to south consistently. We start at the top with the tribe of Dan. Then we saw that Asher's territory was next, so we have parallel strips running across the territory for each tribe. We don't know how deep these strips are, but it appears to me that they're probably equal to the, or consistent with the size of the tribe, with the population of the tribe. So we have Dan, Asher. South of Asher is Naphtali. South of Naphtali is Manasseh. Then Ephraim, remember Ephraim and Manasseh, the two tribes of Joseph. There is no tribe of Joseph mentioned here, but his two children are mentioned. Following Ephraim, to the south is Reuben. Remember, this is the tribe whose patriarch lost the blessing of the firstborn through his immorality with his father's concubine. But the tribe is still honored by a spot in the kingdom. Then comes Judah. Judah, the faithful tribe, the tribe of the Messianic king, and it's located in a place of honor right next to Millennial Mount Zion. Then we took a look at Millennial Mount Zion and some of the features up on the mountain. We saw, as we continued moving from north to south, that the northern section of Millennial Mount Zion will be considered most holy, and then the center section will be have a less holiness, less sanctity. The northern section being most holy is logical, because the temple is there and the sons of Zadok will be living there. The middle section being a notch down in sanctity is logical, because the rest of the tribe of Levi will be living there. And finally, we saw that the southern section of Millennial Mount Zion will be for common use. So this is very similar to the temples and the tabernacle, where increasing sanctity as we move toward the temple. And of course, in the southern area is the Millennial Jerusalem, where members of all tribes will be living. Jerusalem will be a city that is possessed by all the tribes of Israel. Then we got a close-up of the city. We saw that it was about 8 2/3 miles, almost 9 miles square. But then there's a green belt making the around the city that's neither planted, just some kind of a green belt that sets it off from the crop growing areas, from the farming areas to the east and west of the city. And this green belt makes the total outside dimension of the city approximately 10 miles. Okay? In this diagram, we also see the Millennial River flowing into Jerusalem and then breaking into rivers and streams, as the prophets state, and then flowing out eventually east and west to the Dead Sea and over to the Mediterranean. Now, at the very end of the lesson today, we'll take a look at Jerusalem that is measured using the cubit measurement that many commentators use, making Jerusalem quite a bit smaller than 10 miles square. And one of the reasons why I think the reed measurement that we've been using is more logical lies in the fact of this river. You know, if you're going to have streams and rivers and canals in Jerusalem, tiny little Jerusalem just doesn't fit the bill. But we'll see that in just at the end of the session tonight. So there was a little look at Millennial Jerusalem. Then we noted the prince's portion to the east and west of the Holy Oblation, the Millennial Mount Zion, where David and his family would possess territory. And that brings us now to page 711 and point 6 at the top of the page, as we continue from north to south, Now we pick up the five southern tribes. Okay, everybody there? Everybody all set? So we're in chapter 48, verse 23, and we come to the tribe that is abuts the holy oblation to the south, Benjamin, verse 23. As for the rest of the tribes, from the east side to the west side, Benjamin, one portion. And on your outline, you see that point A2, Benjamin was the son of Rachel, one of the matriarchs, and this was a tribe that was loyal to David. And so apparently that for that reason, because they're associated with Rachel, and because of their loyalty, they have a position of honor right next to Millennial Mount Zion, just to the south of it. So they have a band of territory east to west, just below Millennial Mount Zion. Verse 24, Simeon. Beside the border of Benjamin, from the east side to the west side, Simeon, one portion. And if you drop down to B2, you see he's a son of Leah. Again, another, in fact, the premier matriarch. She was Jacob's first wife, primary wife, and she gave birth to most of the tribes of Israel. One of them was Simeon, a tribe descendant of Leah. And so he is his strip of territory comes in below Benjamin. And you can see the territory is going to get narrower and narrower as we go down, as we head south. So my thought would be that these are the smaller tribes, with Reuben, Ephraim, Manasseh, etc., Judah being the larger tribes, and Benjamin, Simeon, and the rest being the tribes of smaller population. But we'll see exactly how it works out when we get there. Okay, verse 25. We now come to Issachar, verse 25. Beside the border of Simeon, on the east side to the west side, Issachar, one portion. And of course, you notice point C2, another son of Leah, another son of the chief matriarch. So we put Issachar in here below Simeon somewhere. Point D, verse 26. Beside the border of Issachar, from the east side to the west side, Zebulun, one portion. And again, D2, we see another son of Leah. So we'll drop Zebulun in here just below Issachar. Okay, pretty straightforward, right? We're going to be done with the chapter before you know it, right? Nah, I can't just let it go at this. Yes, question?
Why the dotted line?
Okay, the dotted line recognizes the possible existence. We know that Moab and Ammon and Moab will be in existence in the kingdom, okay? And they were located, Ammon in this area, Moab in this area. And we also noted that the border of Israel will run up the desert. So the dotted line recognizes, well, let's put it this way, the solid line recognizes that this may be the formal borders of the promised land, but the dotted line recognizes that these two territories will be under Jewish sovereignty. We learned that from Isaiah, the book of Isaiah. Now, it's possible that Ammon and Moab could be constituted a little further to the east here, and then this all would be Jewish territory, but we'll see when we get there. Okay, so that's why the little notch and the dotted line. Okay.
So they each have their fiefdom.
Each a tribe.
Yes.
Yeah, each tribe has their territory east to west.
And from the standpoint of anthropomorphic view, are they in what configuration? Are they mortal, immortal?
Yes, these will be Jewish people in natural bodies. They will all be believers,
but
in natural bodies, and so they will live throughout the 1,000 years of the kingdom, like pre. Yes.
And the tribal integrity will be maintained by what standard? No intermarriage between the tribes.
Well, it doesn't seem to be, because remember we saw the tribe of Levi was told, we're going to throw the lot for you, and you're going to be assigned your family plot. Don't sell it. Don't trade it. Be content with it. Remember that with Levi?
Right.
I suspect that policy will probably extend to the...
So no intermarriage?
Probably not. We'll see.
Somebody from Judah falls in love with somebody from
It doesn't say.
Now we're back to...
It doesn't say.
Levi was a, it,
It doesn't say. So.
Saudi prevent the aggravation.
So really, it's up in the air. We'll see.
It's up in the air. So is the future of aviation.
Yeah, right. So is the future of Boeing. They can't get the Dreamliner off the ground. Okay. Anyway, we'll see when we get there. I didn't know I was that funny. Okay, so yeah, that's really an impossible question to answer, I think, right now. Okay. All righty, can I go on? All righty, page 712. Page 712, verse 27. We come to Gad. That was my line. Beside the border of Zebulun, from the east side to the west side, Gad, one portion. And again, point E2. Now, he is a son of Zilpah. And Zilpah was a handmaid of Leah. So these tribes basically have an association. These bottom tribes basically have an association with Leah. And, of course, Benjamin, though, having the association with Rachel. All right, then in verse 28, let me drop Gad in. There he is. Okay, couldn't forget him. All right. Then the southern border of the territory is repeated once again. We've seen this earlier in the study, verse 28. And beside the border of Gad, at the south side, toward the south, the border shall be from Tamar to the waters of Meribath Kadesh, from the brook of Egypt to the great sea. And so the southern border basically is repeated. And again, I believe that this will be initial borders that will be expanded to the final borders of the kingdom. Again, this is the scenario that seems very logical to me, that in the middle of the tribulation, the modern state of Israel collapses as Antichrist forces overrun Jerusalem. The Jewish people are on the run, cast out of the land into the second worldwide diaspora. The most important a group of Jewish people being holed up right in this area down in here in Basra or Petra. But the nation has collapsed. Jerusalem has fallen under the control of the Antichrist. After 3.5 years, Yeshua returns at the cry of the Jewish people. He returns to defeat Israel's enemies and to save the Jewish people from annihilation and to institute the Messianic kingdom. As he institutes the Messianic kingdom, he could very well start with the initial borders of Numbers 34, which are the same borders mentioned down here. These would be the borders mentioned in verse 28 of chapter 48 of Ezekiel. And remember, Numbers 34 was initial borders only. Remember, we looked at the verses that talked about the fact that God would expand the borders of the kingdom to the full promised extent based on obedience. I'm not going to drive out those nations all at once from before you. Why? Because the wild animals would become too much for you. I'm going to drive them out piece by piece, little by little, and I'll expand your territory. So that could be the initial borders of the nation of Israel in the kingdom. Then as more and more Jewish people are born into the nation, the northern tribes could expand out to the borders. The conventional view of the borders found in Ezekiel 47. So we have the minimalist view here and the conventionalist view here. And then Bob's view, as more and more Jewish people are born, the borders would extend to its full promised extent from the Wadi al-Arish somewhere down here to the Euphrates River. We have to keep the fact that the borders have to extend up north into Hittite country and up to the Euphrates River somehow. So I believe that the borders mentioned here are the preliminary borders. Does that make sense? Yes.
The Brook of Egypt
is the Wadi al-Arish in this approximate location right in here. Well, because that's the best candidate. This area, the eastern arm of Egypt, would mean that the Jewish people entered the promised land as soon as we crossed the Red Sea. Or if the eastern branch of the Nile is the river of Egypt, the instant we stepped across that branch, we were in the promised land. That didn't happen. So those two borders are not cannot possibly be the River of Egypt. However, before we went into the Promised Land, we were camped at Kadesh Barnea, right about there, just to the south of the Wadi Al Arish.
There's a viable river there too.
It's a wadi. Oh yeah, the town of Arish is located right here. It's a dry riverbed during the summer, and it flows with water during the winter. Yes. Yes, it flows from the middle of the Sinai Peninsula. There's a number of branches of it. They come together right about in here, and then they curve around out to the ocean. Yes, the Wadi Al Arish, prominent landmark there. Okay, make sense? Okay, question. Well, the only people today that know what tribe they're from is the tribe of Levi. The rest of us are just B'nai Israel. But God knows which tribe we belong to. Okay? Yeah, Petra Basra. Yeah, in the remarks about Petra and Judah, God says, I will save the tents of Judah first. So it appears that a lot of the people living in Petra will be predominantly from the tribe of Judah. Yeah, he will save the tents of Judah first. That's the initial point of the second coming.
So.
Well, yeah, it could also just be referring to the fact that it could be a generic term too, but it also could mean that the majority would be from the tribe of Judah. We'll just have to see. We don't know today what tribe we belong to. Only God knows right now. Okay. All righty. Now, before we go on here. All right, page 712.7. At the bottom of the page is a summary of all that we've looked at in chapter 48, verse 29. This is the land which you shall divide by lot to the tribes of Israel for an inheritance. And these are their several portions, declares the Lord God. I want you to take a look at point 7a, parentheses 1. I don't care how you highlight it, but I want you to highlight parentheses 1 at the bottom of the page there. If you have a highlighter, draw a yellow line through it. If you have a pencil, put stars to the left of it. I don't care how you do it. Put a post-it note there. Okay, what does that little note say? For the first time, all of the promised land, and you can add to that sentence, will be possessed by the Jewish people. For the first time, all, circle the word all. For the first time, all of the Jewish land will be possessed by the Jewish people. Very important statement. Because we've been promised a certain territory, but the Jewish people have never occupied all of the promised land, and we do not do so today. We do not do so today. We never have, and we do not do so today. Now, when we look at possession of the promised land, there's a couple of biblical principles I want you to keep in mind. So I wrote them big. All right, here's the first one. I wrote it so big that you can take off your glasses and still read it, right? Can you guys in the back row read it with your glasses off? Okay. Principle. Jewish ownership of the land is unconditional based on the Abrahamic covenant. What this means is that the Jewish people own the promised land. We were given the title deed by God when he gave it to Abraham, reaffirmed it to Isaac, reaffirmed it to Jacob, reaffirmed it to their descendants, the 12 tribes. This is the basis for Jewish possession of the promised land. This is the basis for the institution of the modern state of Israel today, the Abrahamic covenant. I'm going to give you a moment or two to copy that short little sentence down for those of you that want to do that. And I want to emphasize a couple of principles here because of all the stuff that's going on today in the political realm. And I want you to give a better answer than a lot of people give when they justify the existence of the state of Israel. All right, everybody got that principle?
Mm-hmm.
We have been given the promised land, and it's not on the basis of whether we are good people or bad people or whatever. God has said, you will get the promised land. It's an unconditional promise. Now, it does come with a caveat, but anyway. All right, now let's take a look at what's going on.
When will we come?
In the Messianic Kingdom, the institution of the Messianic Kingdom. All right, now even on Zionist, pro-Zionist websites, you get a bad answer to the existence, for justifying the existence of the modern state. This is a www.zionism-israel.com, and they had this question up there. Was Israel created because of the Holocaust? And here is their reply to this question. Anti-Zionists argue that Israel was created because the nations of Europe took pity on the Jews after World War II, and that the right to a Jewish state can be rescinded if Israel doesn't behave. Is Israel behaving? Of course not. Israel's not behaving. The racist president of Iran has actually suggested that Israel should be moved to Europe. Now, these people who take this position that Israel is created just because the European countries were all guilt-ridden over Hitler, and so we got to give the poor Jews a home, at least they acknowledge the Holocaust, right?
Yeah.
At least they acknowledge the Holocaust, okay? Ahmadinejad doesn't even acknowledge the Holocaust. So the idea is that these big, terrible European nations trampled on the rights of the Palestinians and set up the modern state of Israel, and where the Palestinians have lived since time immemorial. And so Israel can be, it was set up, it can be taken apart if the Jews don't behave. And of course, how the Jews behave is up to your point of view. Now, how do you answer this modern argument that the modern state of Israel is nothing but a guilt trip by the European nations? There you go, Cynthia, you got it. Okay, here you, I'm gonna tell you the answer that this website, I'm going to put that up, the answer that the website gives. Now, this is a pro-Zionist, pro-Israel website, but here's the answer they give, okay? It's the wrong answer, it's historically correct, but it is non-biblical. Now, you listen to this, and don't fall for this trap. Here's how they answered that charge. Actually, Israel was created as a result of the League of Nations mandate in 1922. Which granted a mandate to Great Britain to create a national home for the Jews in Palestine. This right was based on the rights of self-determination, a right shared by all peoples. All right, that's historically accurate. But who was behind the League of Nations? Who used the League of Nations to reinstitute the state of Israel? Is the League of Nations in charge of the world?
No.
Is the UN in charge of the world?
No.
The UN might think they're in charge of the world.
Predicated in large part on what preceded, which was the Balfour Declaration.
Sure, yeah. Is Balfour in charge of the world?
Yeah.
See, this is an historical argument, and anyone can out-debate you on this.
Right.
You know, you can make this argument, but somebody out there will, you know, refute it, okay? So you can't, it's the wrong answer to use the historical argument. Israel has a right to exist because the League of Nations voted it in. Well, UN can vote it out, right? Okay, the basis for the state of Israel is the Abrahamic covenant. Okay, the basis for the state of Israel is because the King of Kings and Lord of Lords said, "I've given this territory to the Jewish people." All right, and they have to argue with God on that. All right.
Is the nation
still viable today? No. They phased out into the UN many years ago. They were very ineffective, and the UN replaced it.
What was the League of Nations?
It was a League of Nations that were formed after World War I to, I don't know what the philosophy behind it would be, but to, you know, try to make a better world.
European and America?
Yeah,
we were part of the League of Nations.
We were brought together as a function of the settlement of
did we ever join it?
The Senate said no.
Senate said no. Okay, we were not part of the League of Nations. It was a European thing. It was the League of Nations decided that, yes, we can, Europe should make a home for the, the Jewish people should have a home, homeland back in their historical territory. Okay, go to Wikipedia and just look at an article there on the League of Nations, okay? Don't use this argument, that's all I'm saying. Go back to the scriptures, go back to the Bible, and look at the true foundation, true authority for the modern state of Israel. Okay, just like Cynthia said, if you reject the Bible as authority, then of course all you're left with is this historical argument. Okay, so don't make it. Yes?
Okay. We believe in the Bible, but what I understand people who are secular, going for that stuff, but what about the replacement theologists who still, even though they know the Bible, are talking trash?
Well, the replacement theologian is usually an amillennialist, they're very different stripes. But they see the state of Israel today as just simply an historical anomaly, just something that happened. It has nothing really to do with the Bible, because when the Bible is talking about the Messianic Kingdom, it's really talking about the church, you know, all that. It's not really talking about a literal state for the literal Jewish people. They've been rejected. They've been replaced by the church. So that's how they come at it, you know, yeah. They'll recognize the literal interpretation, but then they'll go to the allegorical. This really speaks of the church. I gave you an article by John Gill, an earlier replacement theologian, and we went through all the measurements of the temple, and he said, here's the measurements of the temple. This is really the gospel church, you know, okay? Yes. Okay, the term Palestine came into use by the Emperor Hadrian. He got fed up with the rebellious Jews, the Second Jewish Revolt, and in an attempt to eradicate any Jewish identification with the land of Israel, he renamed it Syria-Palestinia. He renamed it a province of Rome called Land of the Philistines. That's what Palestine means, Land of the Philistines. It was an insult to the Jewish people, and it was an attempt to eradicate Jewish presence in the land and ownership of the land. That name Palestine has stuck since then.
That's why, okay. I asked the second part of the
right
question. What did they have in mind historically?
Geographically and historically, there's never been a country called Palestine. It's always been a province of a larger entity, most recently the Ottoman Empire, the Ottoman Turks, and the idea of a Palestinian homeland, a Palestinian nation, was created right around 1967 by the Palestinian Liberation Organization under Yasser Arafat as a political tool.
Basically, for the record, if I understand you correctly, there is no definitive
as Palestine. Exactly. No, never. Never. Okay, yes.
Actually, in the first Palestinian, or the first term Palestinians, was referring to Jews living in the land.
Right. When the Jewish people came back to the land, everybody was a Palestinian because they all lived in Palestine, Arab and Jew alike, you know.
And then Walid Shoban said that he was an ex-terrorist, now Lieber said, how come one day in 1967 I was a Palestinian, next day I woke up. Palestinian,
yeah, exactly. Because it was propaganda put together by the Arab nations and the Palestinian Liberation Organization.
Oh?
Huh? Around 135 AD. Oh, yeah. Many commentaries and maps still label this area as Palestine. Yeah. Oh, yeah, the convention has not disappeared. Yeah, I agree with you. All right, you guys take a break, and we'll take a look at the second principle right after our break, okay? All right, we're back underway again. All right, so the first principle is that Jewish ownership of the land is unconditional based on the Abrahamic covenant. Second principle, again, writ large so you can read it without your glasses. Enjoyment of the land blessings and the land promise is contingent on obedience. This is the caveat I was talking about. Enjoyment of the land blessing, the land promise, is contingent on obedience. Okay, write that down. I'll give you a second or two to fill that in. We'll see how this works out over time. Enjoyment of the land blessing, enjoyment of the land promise is contingent on obedience. Why aren't the Jewish people in the land? All of the land today. Okay, everybody have that? All right, everybody get it? Enjoyment of the land blessing, the land promise is contingent on obedience. All right, let's move on. Now, let's take a look at this principle of expansion for obedience. We've seen this before, Deuteronomy 19, 8 and 9. I've read it to you on a number of occasions, so I just want to read the highlighted portions. God says, if the Lord your God enlarges your territory... When we first entered the promised land, we did not receive all of the territory. He promises to enlarge our territory as he has sworn to your fathers. But what's the basis for enlarging the territory step by step, piece by piece, so that he would drive out the nations before us little by little so that the wild animals wouldn't be too much for us? The basis for that, if you carefully observe all this commandment, then I'll increase the size of the territory. And here he's speaking about cities of refuge. Cities of refuge were cities set aside for somebody who had committed manslaughter. The city was a fairly close proximity to the general population. He could flee to the city and get a fair trial rather than the avenger of blood going after him and avenging the death. But as the territory of Israel expanded, it'd be harder and harder and harder to get to a city of refuge unless you increase the number of cities of refuge. So that's what he's talking about here. I will enlarge your territory as I have sworn to your fathers if you carefully obey me. Then I will do it. So that's an example of the principle of expansion for obedience. Now, here's an example of the principle of contraction for disobedience. And this is 2 Kings 10, 31 and 32. 2 Kings 10, 31 and 32. Notice what this says. But Jehu was not careful to walk in the law of the Lord. He's one of the kings. He was not careful to walk in the law of the Lord, the God of Israel, with all his heart. He did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam, which he made Israel sin. In those days, here's the reaction to the fact that this king was bad and was not obedient. God's response, in those days, the Lord began to what? Cut off portions from Israel. And Hazazel defeated them throughout the territory of Israel. So here the northern kingdom is contracting in size because of disobedience. Rather than expanding in size due to obedience, we now have the nation contracting due to disobedience. Yes?
This is a little confusing because, like, the last one was Deuteronomy, which is the law of Moses, which is fulfilled. So, how is that applicable today?
The same principle applies to all the covenants. There's always blessing for obedience and discipline for disobedience. Even though the covenant will be fulfilled, it's expected that the Jewish people will live in obedience to the covenant to receive the blessings. And eventually that will come to pass, as we'll see in just a second. Well, yes, the Jewish people are still under the Mosaic covenant today. They haven't entered into the new covenant because of unbelief and rejection of the new covenant. Yeah. Okay. All righty. Okay, let's take a look and see how this works out over time. I'm going to pass out this chart to you, and we'll build it quickly. And you'll see how Jewish possession of the land has expanded and contracted over time due to obedience and disobedience. I think you've probably received it before, yeah. How do these principles work out over time in the history of the Jewish people? That's the point of this chart. All righty, got him. All right, any extras here? Everybody got them all? Okay, everybody have one? All righty, let's build this chart piece by piece and see how this works out over time. All righty, let's begin with Abraham. Abraham came into the land. He was given the Abrahamic covenant, promising him the land. How much of it did he own? Burial plot. You know, a tiny, tiny little percentage of 1%. Okay, so Abraham didn't really possess much of the land. When we came into the land after the Exodus, during the book of Judges, we began to possess the land. It began with the hill country. Under the United Kingdom, the land expanded to its farthest extent to date. First under Saul, then under David, and then under Solomon. But then Solomon fell apart, and so the land contracted. Remember this map I showed you? Here is Saul's kingdom. Under obedient David, the territory expanded to this orange area. And then under Solomon, who got off to a good start, the influence of the Jewish people expanded all the way up to the Euphrates River. God never drove out all the people that lived up in this area. We just had economic control over this area. Then Solomon fell apart and got into his idol worship. And then the land began to contract. First of all, when the kingdom divided after Solomon's reign into the northern and southern kingdoms, and we lost some territory. Then the Assyrians conquered the northern kingdom. The northern kingdom was gone in 722. We've just looked at the Babylonian conquest of the southern kingdom and the destruction of Jerusalem. Now the vast majority of the Jewish people are outside of the land. Most of them in Babylon, some of them in Egypt. But the land is basically desolate of the Jewish people. After 70 years, we return. We begin to possess more of the land. Under the Maccabees, during the Hellenistic period, we kick out those mean old Greeks who are oppressing us, and we gain some more territory back, but that only lasted about 100 years. And then the mean old Romans came in, and they conquered us and began to divide up the land again, and so our ownership of the land shrunk again until finally the first worldwide dispersion began. In 70 AD was the first first Jewish revolt. Jerusalem was destroyed, the temple was destroyed. We returned to the land until 135 and the second Jewish revolt, and the Romans were tired of us, and we were finally ejected from the land wholesale and entered the first worldwide dispersion around 135 AD. We've been in that first worldwide dispersion for some 2,000 years. Now we come to the second chart, the modern possession of the land. Okay, the first worldwide dispersion began to come to an end around 1839 in the beginning of the Zionist movement. The first worldwide regathering was accomplished by 1948. The Zionist movement began around 1839 and culminated in the formation of the modern state of Israel in 1948. For about 100 years, we were returning to the land. And we were buying back our own territory. We were purchasing it back from the Arab landowners who were living in the land. Kind of ironic that we had to buy our own territory back. Well, with the War of Independence in 1948, five, or sometimes you can consider it six, Arab armies invaded. But the Lord saw to it that we defeated them and our territory increased even more. In the Six-Day War, 1967, our territory expanded again with the conquest of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. That about till about 40% of the Promised Land. It remained the same throughout the Yom Kippur War. The State of Israel almost collapsed in 1973 with the Yom Kippur War, but we did win that one too, by the grace of God. Lebanon War, we moved into Lebanon and went after the PLO. Our territory remained the same. The Gulf War of 1990, we didn't get involved in that, even though Saddam Hussein threw a bunch of Scuds into Israel to try to get us involved. But then the peace process began in 1991. And the land of Israel has begun to contract ever since. Where will it go in the near future? We're now looking at the possibility of the creation of a Palestinian state in the West Bank. And we've pulled out of Gaza. What will happen? I don't know. I'm not a prophet. I have a stinking suspicion that a Palestinian state may very well be set up. And our territory will contract even more. Remember, we are in the land in unbelief. The vast majority of the Jewish people living in the land today are atheist or agnostic. Okay? 99% of us reject the Messiahship of Jesus. So we are under discipline, and I would not be surprised to see the territory of the State of Israel contract again. Yes, question, Bonnie? Well, I think there was more of a belief in God in those days. Israel has become, I think, more and more secular as time has passed. There was more of a sense of God brought us through the War of Independence. God brought us through the Yom Kippur War. There was much more of a sense of that, but not these days. These days, the idea is we did it. We have the power. Yes. Well, this is all by God's grace. No, we've hardly been obedient to the Mosaic Covenant and Yeshua. You know, it's just God has allowed us to possess this amount of land.
So it seems whether right now in today's period, whether it expands or contracts, it's like they're pretty much in disobedience. Until
We are back in the land in unbelief.
And it's all grace.
There's a certain amount of respect for God in the ultra-Orthodox community, but they tend to follow the traditions rather than the Mosaic law, you know. And there are believers in the land, 1% or so do believe in Yeshua, so there's some grace being poured out for that reason. And we'll get into the doctrine of the remnant. Well, it's a very important doctrine, but it's the remnant that keeps Israel alive today. Okay? Well, what'll happen in the near future, I don't know, but I do know that in the middle of the tribulation period, the state of Israel will collapse. And we'll be cast into the second worldwide dispersion. It'll last 3.5 years as the Antichrist tries to annihilate the Jewish people. But at the end of that 3.5 year period, Yeshua will return, and he'll save us and save us from our enemies. He'll reinstitute the state of Israel and bring us back to the land, Isaiah 11, in the second worldwide regathering. And that is when we'll possess all the land during the Messianic Kingdom. We will not possess all the land until the Messianic Kingdom. It's in the Messianic Kingdom that all Jewish people will have their territory in the land of Israel. Every time I look at that map, I kind of wonder where I'll be. You know, I have no idea which tribe I belong to. God knows.
Well, if we're going to visit, I hope we have
oceanfront property, okay. All right, well, you better be praying for it. I like oceanfront property, too, okay?
You're not yet.
Well, I might be down in the Gulf of Eilat. That's really pretty down there.
Where do you think Marlene is?
I don't know, Marlene. I don't know where we'll be. You know, I have no idea. All righty.
I don't know.
All righty, page 713. We got to move along, you guys. You see the idealized diagram of the tribal territories and the Millennial Mount Zion on page 713. Now, as we get to page 714, our focus is on the Millennial Jerusalem. And I handed out this diagram earlier. You already should have this diagram. And we'll move through the material about Millennial Jerusalem in the last five verses of the chapter. We're on page 714. 714. We start at parentheses 1 with the measurements of the city. Verse 30. These are the exits of the city. On its north side, 4,500 by measurement. So we're going to focus in on the gates of the city, the exits or the entrances of the city, the gates. And we begin on the north side, and the length of the north side is stated as 4,500. The NASB has the word cubits inserted in italics, which means the word does not exist. It is a translator's insert. We are using the measurement reeds. That's the better measure to use. So it's about 8, almost 9 miles across the north side. Okay, about 9 miles there. And then the gates are described in verse 31. Verse 31. There shall be the gates of the city, named for the tribes of Israel. Three gates toward the north, the gate of Reuben, the gate of Judah, the gate of Reuben, one, the gate of Judah, one, the gate of Levi, one. Now we'll move around the city clockwise. See, the gates are named after the tribes, after the sons of Jacob, but Ephraim and Manasseh will not be mentioned. Instead, this city will have a Joseph gate. That's because we include Levi as one of the gates. And if you include the tribe of Levi in the count, then you have to make an adjustment somewhere, and that's where the Joseph gate will come in. All right, so let's take a look at the three northward gates. Point B there, we have the Reuben gate here, and the Judah gate here, and the Levi gate there, moving clockwise. All three are sons of Leah, as you see at the bottom of the page, one of the primary matriarchs. All right, page 715. We reach the eastern corner. We take a right turn. And we read verse 32. On the east side, 4,500 shall be three gates. The gate of Joseph, one. The gate of Benjamin, one. The gate of Dan, one. And again, we get the measure. The east side is almost 9 miles. 4,500 reeds, and we have three gates there. We begin with the Joseph gate, and there Ephraim and Manasseh are combined into their father's name, Joseph. Well, that diagram has it on a river, but who knows? Watergate. Oh man, yeah. Outside. You go down to the principal's office. I didn't know that was biblical. How about that? All righty. So this gate is compensating for the fact that there's a Levi gate. See, the key issue in the genealogies and the tribal lists is symmetry. Symmetry. Not necessarily all the tribes. See, Issachar and Manasseh and Ephraim are not listed here, but they are subsumed under Joseph. It's symmetry that's the key. Symmetry. So we still have 12 tribes, 12 gates. That's why the names of the tribes vary from list to list. So if you don't see a tribe in a list, don't jump to any conclusion other than consider it an adjustment for a symmetry. All right, so Joseph, the gate of Joseph, a son of Rachel, one of the matriarchs. Then point B. We come to the gate of Benjamin. Gate of Benjamin here in the center. And this is another son of Rachel, one of the matriarchs. And then moving south one more step, we come to the gate of Dan. But he is a son of Bilhah. And Bilhah was Rachel's maid. So all these gates are connected somehow with Rachel, either directly or through her maid, her handmaid. All right, we travel about 9 miles, and we take another right turn at verse 33. On the south side, 4,500 by measurement, shall be three gates, the gate of Simeon, one, the gate of Issachar, one, the gate of Zebulun, one. So again, the measurement of almost 9 miles is stated. And now we have three gates, and all these gates are sons of Leah, the primary matriarch. And so we work around clockwise. We have the Simeon gate and the Issachar gate and the Zebulun gate. And then our final right turn heading north, verse 34. On the west side, 4,500 shall be three gates, the gate of Gad, one, the gate of Asher, one, the gate of Naphtali, one. And all these gates are related to Leah, the primary matriarch. And so we have the gate of Gad. Say it, Roger. E-Gad. There you go. Okay.
How about Gadzooks?
Gadzooks. That's another name. So that gate has three names. Gad Gate, E-Gad, Gadzooks. Anything more?
Gadabout.
Gadfly.
Works.
Bonnie.
Great Gatsby.
Great Gatsby. Oh, man, that's stretching it there.
It says in here that the Naphtali is Rachel's name.
Okay, where are we looking for here? Oh, I was reading the wrong spot. Yes, okay. All right, I'm sorry. We begin at the bottom with the gate of Gad, son of Zilpah, maid of Leah. Okay? So here's the Gad gate. Then on page, the next page, I'm sorry, I was reading too high in the outline. Page 716, we have the gate of Asher, son of Zilpah, maid of Leah. And finally, on the north here, the Naphtali gate, son of Bilhah, again a maid of Rachel. So these gates are associated with the matriarch's handmaids. And then we come to our last verse. Last verse, finally. So we don't want to go through this verse in a hurry, right? We're going to break it into two parts. Question?
Other than Joseph and Levi, is this the same setup as it was around the tabernacle?
I haven't checked that out. I'd have to look and see. The way the tribal divisions were set up around the tabernacle.
So that's north
this
time.
This is north, yes, that's north.
Okay,
not the same. All righty, the total circumference then around the city is reiterated in verse 35, first part of the verse. The city shall be 18,000 round about. The math is pretty simple. 4,500 reeds times 4. Is 18,000 reeds, and it works out to about 35 and a half miles, approximately, according to our system of measure. But then the more significant part of the verse comes into view, the second part of verse 35. And the name of the city from that day shall be, the Lord is there. So now Jerusalem receives an additional name. The name is Jehovah is there, or Adonai Shema, or the literal Hebrew, Yahweh Shema. Yahweh Shema. Now, Sham means there. Shema, that's the directive hey on the end of it. And so that means over there. So it's like somebody is pointing to Jerusalem and saying, Yahweh is there. There, that's where you'll find God, right there. Yahweh Shema. So that'll be a name of the city. Now you notice point B is a little Talmudic reference. The rabbis noticed that three items were specifically named after the name of God, Yahweh. The first name was attached to the righteous, all the righteous in Isaiah 43:7. Isaiah 43:7. Everyone who is called by my name and whom I have created for my glory, whom I have formed, even whom I have made. So every saved individual, every born-again individual from Adam through the into the eternal state is called by God's name, was created for his glory, formed, made specifically for him and by him. That includes everyone in this room. You're all associated with the nature and glory of God. Okay? Everyone is called by my name. And in the biblical thinking, to be identified with the name of something is to be identified with its character, its essence. It's just not a, it's not just a nice, cute little label stuck on something. A name means something. And so you are associated with God's name. You're associated with his character, all that he is. So it's a high calling to be called by God's name. The second person or item to be called by God's name is the Messiah himself in Jeremiah 23:6. Here's what this reads. In his days, speaking of the Messiah's days, the Messianic kingdom, in his days Judah will be saved and Israel will dwell securely, and this is his name by which he will be called, the Lord our righteousness. Again, literally, Yahweh Tzidkenu, the Lord our righteousness. Now that, folks, is a clear implication of deity, that the Messiah is God himself. He's called by God's name. So here we have a clear implication of the deity of the Messiah. And finally, in this section, Jerusalem is associated with God's name as well, here in verse 35. Now let me make one final comment regarding the dimensions of millennial Mount Zion. Now, many commentators, as I said before, use the measurement of the cubit when measuring some of these areas. Now, the cubit is 21 inches long, the long cubit. Now, if that is the measure we should use, then Mount Zion is, Millennial Mount Zion is only a little over 8 miles square. And Jerusalem itself is just a little under 2 miles square. Now we compare that to the current old city of Jerusalem. The current old city is just about a mile square. All right, so the whole Millennial Mount Zion in Jerusalem is quite a bit smaller than we have even today. Now here's a scale diagram of Millennial Mount Zion if it's only 8.3 miles square. It's really not too big. Now let's go in for a close-up. Here it is. Millennial Mount Zion, 8.3 miles square. Millennial Jerusalem, 1.7 miles square. Now, this position solves all the topographical problems, the terrain of the land, you know, solves all those problems. You don't have to have any great big changes to fit Millennial Mount Zion and Millennial Jerusalem into the scene. But what do you think this little gray splotches here? That's modern Jerusalem. That's modern Jerusalem today. So we have Millennial Mount Zion just barely bigger than modern Jerusalem today. Now, if Millennial Mount Zion is going to have a millennial river and Jerusalem is going to have that river break into streams and canals and all that, it strikes me that's not a reasonable view of Millennial Jerusalem. It's really kind of small and dinky and would never be able to handle the amount of people that are going to flow into Jerusalem during the Feast of Tabernacles. So as you look at that measure of cubits, I think it's really an inadequate measure to use when looking at Millennial Mount Zion and Millennial Jerusalem. Okay, does that make sense? The little one, yeah. This is Millennial Jerusalem right here. Yep. Okay, and that then brings us to the end of our study of the book of Ezekiel. So I'm proud of all of you that have stuck through it. Yeah. Say again. A reed, I believe it's around 10 feet. I'd have to go check it. Now, anybody, we got a couple of minutes. I do have the material. I want to hand out the material for next week on the Kingdom in Isaiah for you. But before we do that, we got a couple of minutes. Does anyone have any thoughts they want to share about the impact that the book of Ezekiel has had on their life at all? You know, just voluntary, no pressure. Yes, Kelly. Yes. Stops at the rapture. Yeah, boom. Yeah, kind of ends there, yeah. Right, the rapture is not the end of the story. Exactly.
We all have to be very grateful because it's not the end of the story, and we have to look forward.
Yeah, oh yeah, we've got the kingdom to look forward to and then into the eternal state. Exactly, good, thank you.
Any implications with regards to the negation of the Sabbath of the land by the Jews during this time period as to why they would be handled the way that they were by God? They abrogated the Sabbath of the land.
Oh, okay, and then...
When that happens, they're kicked out of the land.
Right, exactly, disobedience.
I didn't even reference that.
Well, the Sabbath will be mandatory under the millennial system. Sabbath will be observed again.
In the context of the disobedience of the children of Israel at the time of the prophet.
Yeah, we were...
They were kicked out of the land in part, right?
In part by disobeying the Sabbath, yeah.
The Sabbath of the land.
Right, yeah, exactly. Yeah. All right, one or two more, just a second. Why do I think Ezekiel's not taught systematically? Well, it's a difficult book filled with different concepts and controversial book due to replacement theology. And an awful lot of pastors, I've heard too many pastors say, I stay away from eschatology, I stay away from that stuff because it's not that important. There's more important things to deal with. And so I don't want to get into the controversy. I've heard... Well, I think it's more important than ever to teach the prophets and to teach the whole Word of God. Okay, one more comment, and then I'll hand out material.